Support for WMNF comes from our members and Frog Song Organics. Each week, Frog Song Organics delivers healthy produce and pasture-raised meats directly to homes and businesses in the Tampa Bay area. More at frogsongorganics.com, featuring seasonal crops, online shopping, and CSA.
Welcome to Health and Nutrition with Dr. Fred Harvey here on WMNF Tampa, 88.5 on your dial. If you have any medical questions for Dr. Harvey, call us at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. So how are you doing on this fine Monday morning, Dr. Fred?
It is a beautiful morning, and I am doing quite well, thank you.
Glad to hear it, and yes, it is beautiful out there.
And how was your weekend?
Perfectly non-eventful. Kind of the way I like it. A few little details. I guess they call it the honeydew list, and then pretty quiet.
Very good. Very good. So, welcome to today's Health and Nutrition. And this week we're going to talk a little bit about genetics. Just wanted to mention some news. Tokyo Olympics is proceeding along, and I just heard that report on NPR that, yeah, they've been detecting some coronavirus there. We would expect that. And so, yeah, I think that social distancing and masking can really work there. The people that have been inoculated, they're covered. But there are some people there that aren't inoculated. And so masking is key. Read a study over the weekend that suggested that masks are 84 to 93% effective and in preventing these respiratory. So I think we're still nothing's back to normal. We all just need to keep wearing masks. And I think it just makes sense because they work. Despite what disinformation might have circulated the internet and social media, masks are highly effective. And we can see that because New Zealand and Taiwan, they virtually have no virus. So we can do this globally too. So on to genetics, genomics, epigenetics, and metabolomics. I need to begin with some definitions and understandings so that we can look at this in a more contextual manner. So our bodies are made up of lots of different parts, obviously. And we know about, you know, arms, legs, organs like eyes and hearts and things. But down inside, we have the small building block called the cell. And the cell is not just, a bag of water. The cells are actually very complex little mini, essentially, with lots of their own mini organs called organelles. Inside the cell, we have a nucleus. Nucleus is the command center. It is where the DNA resides. DNA is our genetic material. And within the nucleus, the DNA is active and processes go on surrounding the DNA, and there are protections in there. Many proteins protect the DNA from damage. And RNA is in the nucleus also. RNA is a communication molecule made from DNA. In the cell cytoplasm, which is the watery interior of the cell, there are other organelles, one which we've talked about numerous times on this show, are mitochondria. And mitochondria are the processing centers of the cells. They are the place where fuel is burned to make energy, and they process all of the toxins that come through. Another organelle is called a ribosome. Ribosomes are very interesting because it is upon the ribosome that the genetic material is actually translated into actionable materials like protein. Inside the nucleus, there are molecular components. As I talked about, the DNA, mostly in the nucleus, some does get out occasionally. RNA is in the nucleus and in the cytoplasm because it uses a communication tool. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. It's made of nucleic acids and the sugar deoxyribose. The basic building blocks of nucleic acids include four bases called adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. Not thiamine, like the vitamin, but T-H-Y-M-I-N-E. And except in RNA, the thymine is replaced with another base called uracil. RNA is ribonucleic acid, and it's made of those same nucleic acids, as I said, but the sugar ribose instead of deoxyribose. Genetics. To define genetics, we need to understand these words so that we can talk about them in an organized fashion. Genetics is a study of heredity and the variation of inherited characteristics. Your ancestry follows the DNA that is found in mitochondria because it is consistently from the matrilineal family. The DNA in your mitochondria is transferred only from the mother. So we can actually trace your family history via mitochondrial DNA back to origin, practically. And there have been a lot of studies done that show where specific mitochondrial DNA arises. So we can actually look at your DNA and say, well, you're, 37% Scottish and 53% Northern European and other things. That's a supposition made by comparing the genetics that you have with genetics of people from those areas. Epigenetics is an interesting area, which is related to the genetics. There's a area related to the study of the changes in organisms caused by modification of gene expression rather than alteration of the genetic code itself. Rather than having a mutation in the genetic code, this epigenetic stuff controls the way the genes are expressed. And we used to call it junk DNA. When I was in medical school in the 80s, we didn't know what this stuff did. It's pretty amazing how far we've come in the last 30, 40 years. Junk DNA is now known to be the on-off switches for the gene. So we actually can control how we express our genetics using things that take care of epigenetics in the right way. So what are genes? Genes are the basic physical and functional unit of heredity. In other words, they're what we pass on generation to generation that helps us choose how we're going to live this life. They're the blueprint for the structures, starting with protein. They are, interestingly enough, not separate and discrete. They overlap. And so part of one gene could be incorporated into another gene because that more information is needed to get a different task done. These gene base pairs vary in size from hundreds of bases to millions. And so we've figured out there's somewhere between 20,000 and 25,000 genes in the human genome, but we can't be accurate because of this overlap. The genome, what is the genome? We've heard about that word. The genome is, I'm going to use a bigger word here, the haploid set of chromosomes. A haploid is the single unpaired set. In other words, humans have pairs of all 46 chromosomes. And so we have some redundancy. In the gamete, or the sperm or egg, we only have half that, which enables us to actually then mate and form a full organism. All of the information needed to build and maintain an organism is contained in the genome. And most of these genes are the same across humans, across all families of humans, across all races. It's called the wild type. But less than 1% has variations that can be categorized as mutations or something called single nucleotide polymorphism. Lots of words there, meaning that one base pair gets changed. And it doesn't change the gene very much, but it changes it enough so that we can recognize it. And what these recognized changes are called when they're just polymorphisms or simple changes, they're called alleles, A-L-L-E-L-E-S. Alleles are the recognized forms of each gene. For example, we've talked about this one before, ApoE, apolipoprotein E, is a fat-carrying and detoxification protein, and it has three different alleles, ApoE2, ApoE3, and ApoE4. And we know the variations in them, and we know that there's risks for people with differences in these variations. There's another thing called a mutation, where it's not something that shows up as options, essentially, for people. It just shows up out of the blue. And there's a protein receptor called CCR5. CCR5 is on T lymphocytes. This receptor allows the HIV virus to attach to the cell and enter the cell, causing the mutation or causing the infection. But there is a mutation at the 32 position. It's called CCR5 delta 32. And this change creates a completely different form of the receptor that prevents the virus from entering and infecting. So there are people that have the CCR5 delta 32 mutation that are unable to be infected by HIV. And there are cases now where they've actually done bone marrow transplant in people that had leukemia and replaced their bone marrow with a mutated T lymphocyte that has the CCR5 delta 32 and it's cured their HIV. Very dangerous way to cure HIV because you can die from a bone marrow transplant. And so it's only being done in people that have leukemia and need this therapy. But it's very interesting that this one mutation changes things that much that you can't be infected. What is genomics? Genomics is the branch of molecular biology concerned with the structure, function, evolution, and the mapping of the genome. You know, we just spent 10 years on the Human Genome Project and mapped it out as best we could. Technology has changed since then, and we're getting even better information about it. But this study of the structure, function, and evolution and mapping of these genomes has enabled us to do some fascinating things, like to create genetic information that allows us to make inoculations and immunizations against coronavirus, and to actually make the RNA that Novavax is going to use in the vat to make the coronavirus spike protein. Another important word is called phenotype. Phenotype, P-H-E-N-O-T-Y-P-E. Phenotype is the inheritance passed generation to generation, conferring the physical traits and characteristics of the species. Small variations in these sequences of DNA bases, known as the alleles, are responsible for differences in phenotypic characteristics like skin color, hair color, eye color, blood type, and growth characteristics. So that's how we express our genome. Some of these things really don't have any possible expression changes. Like our hair color is going to be our hair color, and so is our eye color unless we dye them or put contact in. But some of these things can be affected by health and nutrition. So how do these affect health and disease? The concept of genetic susceptibility is important. Our genes give us a blueprint, but they don't define us completely. We are not completely susceptible to every disease that might show up as a possibility in our genes. Genetic makeup contributes to the development of disease, but is not directly causative of an illness. And that's why it's difficult to track down some of these things, because there are many factors involved with how the genes are actually read and expressed. For example, it's only recently since we've done the Human Genome Project that we have recognized that a very devastating illness called Huntington's chorea actually is not single gene associated. We thought it was. If you had the gene, and it's a recessive gene, meaning that it only expresses if you have both copies bad, we found out that not everybody with both copies bad actually goes on to get the disease. And the reason for that is that there are multiple other genes that affect the metabolism that's affected by this bad gene in Huntington's chorea that mitigate it and lessen the impact. And so people actually have different ways of expressing what could be a disease. So how do genes do their job? They do it by conveying coded information into manifestation. So you can think of genes as computer code. You can think of RNA as computer punch cards that feed information into a system and have it do different things. So when you take this blueprint information and transfer it into this creation of proteins, this is what it's doing. The genes code for protein. DNA is transcribed, it's copied into RNA in the nucleus of the cell. Messenger RNA is a specific type of RNA that takes the code and transfers it into the cell fluid or the cytoplasm, and it goes over to the ribosome where the code is then translated into a new structure, specifically a protein like an enzyme or a receptor or a surface marker like blood type markers, type O and type A and and Rh positive and negative. These are all cell surface markers, proteins that are made by gene coding. Another very important word to understand is the metabolome. The metabolome is the total number of metabolites present within an organism's cell or tissue. Optimal cellular function depends on the metabolome, which is created by the proteome. The proteome is all those enzymes and proteins and receptors that are created by the DNA that run the show. Proteins, especially enzymes and receptors, make things happen in the metabolism and facilitate communication between the cells. And they're also really crucial in recognizing foreign substances, as in developing immunity to a shot or a virus. So these proteins need to be configured perfectly to work well and available in the right place and the right quantity and sufficient quantity to get the job done. Insulin is a protein. If you don't have insulin, you have diabetes. If you can't hear the signal, you have diabetes. So diabetes or disease occurs when the balance between all these things is upset and we have genetic variants. So in our current world, we've actually used this very technology to create DNA sequences of coronavirus spike protein and then use the same kind of technology to insert that into the virus in Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca's lab. And then that virus then is used to infect us. And then it injects the DNA from that it's carrying into our cell nucleus and uses our cell nucleus apparatus to create messenger RNA, which then goes into the cell and creates coronavirus spike protein. The mRNA packages are already done. There's no DNA involved. And so our cells take those in, and it goes into the cytoplasm, onto the ribosome, and it creates the coronavirus spike protein. We are really at the dawn of a new era in understanding how we can actually work with our genome and our metabolome to create optimal health. So next week, I want to extend this discussion and talk a little bit more about how this applies to your daily life, looking at the concept of nutrigenomics, how nutrition affects the expression of your genome, and also to look at how lifestyle affects it as well. So it looks like we have some emails coming in, and I don't doubt there are calls. What do we have, Bill?
Well, in a second, we're going to have Clay from Land O'Lakes, so go ahead with an email.
All right. Here's one from Judy. She says, I've heard of at least three people who have had the Moderna dosages and have contracted COVID-19 anyway. Well, that's actually a really good statement, and it's actually totally understandable and acceptable. Vaccines or immunizations do not prevent all illness. They are designed specifically to reduce transmission so that epidemics and pandemics can be slowed and stopped. And they're designed to reduce severity of illness. And so my guess is that the three people Judy knows have had milder disease than they would have had they not had the inoculation. And some may have died, because what we see now is that all of these shots, and this is why I would never deter anyone from getting any of these shots, they reduce death by like 95 to 97%. This is really important for anybody at risk who is at risk of dying from it. And these are, what we're seeing is obese, high blood pressure, diabetes, immune suppression, emphysema. These are the people that are having the most trouble. So these people are at risk. And if they've had their shots, it's much less likely that they're going to be into the hospital or that they are going to die from the problem. She also has a second question. When the Novavax becomes available, will it be possible to get that vaccine even though a person has already had both Moderna shots? Well, what I've read is that they're trying to place the Novavax as a future booster. And they should be able to adapt the Novavax platform to insert into their vats where they're making this spike protein a tweak to the mRNA that they're using so that it actually matches the spike protein variants that are coming in the Delta and Lambda variants. And I believe that what I've read is that Novavax company is already working on adding those in because they know what the sequences are. And since they haven't released yet, they're going to be adding more spike protein variances, I'm pretty certain.
All right. And before we go on off to Clay, I want to just give people a reminder that you're listening to Health and Nutrition with Dr. Fred Harvey here on WMNF Tampa. And if you want to participate in this conversation, give us a call at area 813-239-9663 or continue sending your emails to us at dj@wmnf.org. And here's Clay for you. He's been waiting patiently.
Hello, Clay.
What's up, Doc? Thanks for taking my call.
You're so welcome.
So I have a question for you in regards to what you started with, talking about the Human Genome Project and our genes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
In your talk, you actually said throughout the races, and one of the things that I found concerning was that I thought there was only one race, the human race, and the Human Genome Project actually established that we don't have different races of people. There are differences in us from our genetics, but we're all from the same source.
I'm so glad you made that point, and it's very true. There is only one family, the human family, the human race. Race is a word that has lots of charge to it, and essentially it's based on skin color, which has nothing to do with being human. It has to do with evolution, and so we are all human. We are all Homo something. I'm not sure sapiens is the word, looking around at our environment currently, but yes, I totally agree with you. We are, we really need to eliminate that thought. However, there is something very interesting associated with the concept. Sub-Saharan African genes are different. They evolved to live in that climate. And so the nature of their skin and color and their kidneys and the way they deal with vitamin D and salt and blood pressure is they have some very unique genetic differences that, in a sense, we kind of sort of have to use the word race because there's no other good way of saying it. There's maybe just defining it by the ethnic area, but that doesn't quite do it either because it's genetics. And it's so hard to leave that behind because African Americans have a distinctly different association with salt, fat, sugar, and sun than European Americans. So I hear your point. It's very well taken.
We all started out that way. What happened is that when we left Africa, we being people who are not Africans anymore, we adapted and evolved to the new environments that we went to, which caused those genetic changes.
Yeah.
So medically, I think, yes.
Medically, I have to take it into account, though, because it definitely skews my choices on what I'm going to recommend for a Caucasian versus an African American for what they're going to do for their blood pressure medications and how they're going to deal with sugar and things like that.
But then that's the kind of thing you have to do with people anyway, because we're all individuals and we all have different things that affect us in a different way.
Oh, that's totally true.
Onward. My next question is, because, and you brought it up, you actually hit on all these subjects. I was wanting to know, what's the big holdup in the Novavax? I haven't gotten vaccinated yet. I don't plan to get vaccinated by anything but the Novavax. And they keep pushing back the time when it's going to be made available while they're crying for everyone to get vaccinated. And I'm not anti-vaxxer. I'm just going to, that's just the only one I've decided from my own research and listening to you and other professionals. That's the one for me. That's what I want to take is the Novavax. But how do we get them to speed up the process? Why haven't they done it yet? They went on this tangent and got all these others done in like 3 months, and the Novavax is 9 months out and it's still not been approved or use in the country.
Yeah,
not available.
And they already had the platform, which is very interesting. I'm not sure what wrangling is going on behind the scenes in the pharma world, but. We just heard from Amy Goodman that wrangling in the pharma world is not new to us, and the Purdue pharma fiasco appears to have been well put aside by money from the Sackler family. They bought off some people, apparently. So I don't know what's happening. I've talked with the company about 10 days ago. I was planning on calling them this week to find out what their newest update is. I wish we had better information, but it seems still goes back to their purchase of an ineffective manufacturing plant that couldn't handle the volume. Don't know if that's the whole story, but that's one thing I've read.
So is there anything that we as citizens can do to speed this process up? I mean, the FDA evidently received lots of pressure to do Moderna and Pfizer and then AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. They got all those done in no time whatsoever. And here we are still waiting around for what was probably the best. I think it's so far proven to be the most effective of all of these, some of the medical interventions. We'll call them
Those original data look like it's very good. It's so hard to tell, but I'd say just if you're interested, call the company. Keep on the company and say, where's my vaccine?
Okay, so you want to give out their number?
Actually, it's real easy. I found it by going online and looking at Novavax and going to the bottom of the page, contact us.
Well, the problem for me is I don't have internet access right now. I haven't had it since the pandemic started.
We'll look for that in a bit. I don't have it handy. If I don't give it today, I'll put it on for next week.
I appreciate that.
And I'll post
that.
It on my website.
Listen, thanks so much for all the work you do and for volunteering there at the station and giving people such great information. I wish that what could happen is that the entire country would end up being functional medical doctors instead of just, you went through the whole process because you started out as a doctor, just as a doctor yourself, and then you got into functional medicine when you realized things weren't quite working the way that they should, that you were better off.
More and more of us are coming every day. I'm part of a mastermind group where more and more of us are educating our colleagues so they know about this stuff. It's really exciting. We're going to change the world.
I hope so. Well, peace be upon you all. Stay healthy, and thanks again for the show.
You're so welcome. Have a great day.
Bye now.
You ready for another call there, Doctor?
Certainly.
All right. I got Jay from Pasco and follows on up well here with a question about his reaction to the Moderna shot.
Hello, Jay.
Yes, Doc, thanks for taking my call. I had a Moderna vaccine shot about 2 weeks ago. For the last 6 months, I've been taking my blood pressure. It's been 103 to 129 over 70. After the Moderna shot, my pressure shot up to about 140 over 80, the second number being 80. So I was wondering, is that because of my heart? Did it affect my heart?
We don't know exactly how all of these things are occurring in the system, but one of the possibilities here is that we know that the coronavirus spike protein works through the angiotensin receptor, apparently. Angiotensin is associated with control of vascular tone, the tightness of the blood vessels, and it causes high blood pressure. Angiotensin makes your blood pressure go up, and angiotensin blockade, there are medications that block it, so the blood pressure goes back down. So you could actually be dealing with some what's called endothelial dysfunction. The lining of the blood vessels could be ticked off from that. Things that may help in this instance are taking more magnesium. Magnesium glycinate is a good one, 400 milligrams a day. And curcumin extract, turmeric extract, and some resveratrol or terostilbene, terostilbene, is methylated resveratrol, very potent stuff. These things can really, and quercetin, quercetin, 500 milligrams twice a day. These things can really be helpful at calming down vascular inflammation, and that may help your blood pressure.
Okay, I've also at times been taking some herbs for expanding, the removing the cholesterol and expanding the thing. Niacin comes to mind. It seems to...
Niacin is a blood vessel dilator.
Okay, so that would be one also to take.
That might help, but actually I think the other ones are more directed at the endothelial dysfunction.
Okay, I understand. One other question is, when you were talking earlier about the Maduro virus, there was a point where the booster shot was being replaced by something else, by a new booster shot.
Not out yet. Right. Novavax Corporation is making a coronavirus vaccine, and they were going to apply for emergency use authorization this quarter, somewhere between July 1 and September 30th. And they haven't given a specific date. They're just hoping to file soon.
Okay, so I have the schedule after 28 days to get the booster shot. Should I wait?
You need to do the first two shots of Moderna. It's not a booster. That's the whole dose. Moderna is a two-dose immunization. The booster would come 8 months, a year later, if it was needed for a different variant. But no, the Moderna is a two-shot dose. It's not a booster.
Right. Okay. So go ahead get that second one and wait. Doctor,
I would do it because you get very little benefit from one dose of either Pfizer or Moderna. You need two. It's only about 30% effective if you get only one.
Right. Okay, I'll do it and I appreciate it, Doc. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. What you got, Bill?
All right, and you're right. We got a couple of callers, but first I'm going to do a little promo and shout out to folks to support us. And it's a thanks to every listener who supports WMNF by donating to us. And we'll be asking for your support to keep us broadcasting on Monday, July 26th and Tuesday, July 27th. You can donate early at WMNF.org or by calling 813-238-8001 weekdays and holidays. Thank you very much, and thanks for your support in listening to WMNF Tampa. And so we've got, let me get to here. Looks like Paul from Riverview for us.
Good morning, Paul.
Hello. Hi, Dr. Harvey.
Hi.
What did can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Do you have a question?
I'm going to move on to Terry here.
Yes.
Hello?
Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have a friend who hasn't been vaccinated, and I'm trying to prevail upon him to do so, especially since he rides public transportation and works with the public, so he's got a lot of exposure. And he is a vegan, and he is saying that he does not want to get the vaccine because any animal product he ever has in his body makes him deathly ill, and he has heard that vegetarians and vegans have the worst possible side effects to the vaccines. I don't know anything about that, but I was wondering if you had any responses.
People who eat a solid vegan diet are pretty darn healthy because they have so many phytonutrients and antioxidants on board, and they are tend to be alkaline and not toxic with lots of fat. So they should have a good response. I don't know of any animal products in any of the current available immunizations. The Johnson & Johnson is a viral vector. It's a human cold virus. So as far as I know, there's no egg or any kind of other things in that preparation, though I'm not sure, but the mRNA is completely synthetic. So there shouldn't be a problem.
I didn't think so. So he should not be more likely to get horrible side effects from his second shot because he's vegan.
No. Actually, if somebody is doing a solid vegan diet, really a good one,
he is.
They should have lower effects. If they're doing a marginal vegan diet where they're eating, fake soy cheese on white bread, they're probably not going to do well. But if they're eating a solid 8 servings a day of vegetables and fruit, I think they'll be fine.
Okay. All right. I'll try that on him. Thanks.
Very good.
Bye.
You're welcome. Here's the one from Margaret Kay. She was hoping to get some help with her left big toenail bed. She has some soreness, and bed sheet even causes discomfort, but it's not red or swollen. She cuts her nails the right way, straight across, so the corners don't go into the bed of the nail, and her pedicure technician actually did some work and helped relieve some of the pain, but it's still there. Even though it's not red or swollen, I think I would get the opinion of a podiatrist, someone who's professional at this, because it's hard to tell without seeing it what's actually going on there. Do we have a call?
No, it's all quiet on the frontier, so I'm going to take an opportunity again to give out our number and stuff. Give me a second here. As a reminder, you're listening to Health and Nutrition with Dr. Fred Harvey here on WMNF Tampa. If you have any medical questions for Dr. Fred, you can jump in on the conversation by just calling 813-239-9663 or send your email to dj@wmnf.org. You can also text us at 813-433-0885. Again, just give us a call, 813-239-9663 or dj@wmnf.org. Okay, Dr. Fred, go on.
So I have one here from Gib. Love the show and the info. I would like to help my 16-year-old daughter with high cholesterol. Mine is also a tad high. She's a bit overweight and does not have a healthy diet. Loves Mexican restaurant and cheese sauce. She does exercise a little bit. I think the best approach for someone who has elevated cholesterol at 16 is to really evaluate the diet. I wouldn't go anywhere near a supplement at this point. First of all, I would go to a plant-based diet. What I mean by that is the modified Mediterranean diet, where you eat 80 to 90% plant and 10 to 20% animal. Cut back on the cheese. The Mediterranians in the Mediterranean, who did use cheese, used it as a condiment because it's very expensive, and you only get a small amount of it every year from the dairy products that you save. It's not a commodity like it is in American grocery stores. We live in luxury here. So cheese is a flavoring agent and a fat additive, not for a principal food source. Vegetables. Your daughter should be getting anywhere between 5 and 8 servings of vegetables, cooked and raw, and 2 servings of fruit, preferably berries. Right now, mangoes are in, and mangoes have great soluble fiber. Soluble fiber helps to lower cholesterol. So work on making the diet your medicine. Make your food change your genetic expression.
All right. Well, it looked like that last time the announcement for the phone number did the trick. We've lit up the board. Here's Daryl from Largo.
Hi, Daryl.
Hi, doctor. I've been suffering from anxiety since I lost my business. And it's been almost 2 years now. And I'd like to know why anxiety has an effect more in the morning, in the daytime, than it does as the day wears on. I don't feel this background anxiety. It's gotten better, but, you know, I'm on Klonopin.
Well, that's really an interesting observation. You're very aware. The morning reason for elevated anxiety is that between 6 and 10 in the morning, your adrenaline levels peak. Your testosterone levels peak, and your cortisone levels peak. So you're basically already in kind of a stress mode, and if you already have an intellectual or mental or emotional connection to something that's bothering you, you're going to make it worse, more than likely, by thinking about it. I think one of the best things you could consider, if you don't have it now, is a meditation practice. Do you do that?
I am already on an antidepressant and a Klonopin.
Yes. Do you have a meditation practice where you meditate and quiet?
Oh, meditating.
Yes.
I'm doing a diaphragm breathe in, where I try to make my diaphragmatic breathing.
Yes, that's very good. Very key. There's a wonderful app for the smartphone called Insight Timer. On that, there are numerous guided meditations and different types of music. Binaural beats really help to calm the system down. Look for binaural beats. And another thing is to play in the background at home 432 hertz. 432 hertz music, you can find it on YouTube and other places. That is a very anti-anxiety calming thing. Daily meditation, daily exercise, walking outside for 30 minutes is really key for helping people get rid of anxiety.
Okay.
Is that good for you?
Well, I mean, I go to the gym, and it's still...
Yeah, gyms are inside.
The morning,
I'm saying walk
the morning.
Outdoors. Walking outdoors is very uplifting for the spirit.
Okay.
I hope that helps.
All right.
Do we have somebody else on the line?
Yes, we do. We've got Kevin from Venice here for us. Hey there, Kevin.
Hi there. Good morning, Dr. Harvey. The Novavax vaccine, you're saying it's probably won't be till September.
I have no idea. They said they will file for emergency use sometime between July 1 and September 30th, so it's hard to tell when it will be here.
Okay. My wife and I, we're not vaccinated. We were waiting for the Novavax, and we both worked for the school board. And Sarasota County, in their infinite wisdom, decided to make masks, you know, let people decide if they want to wear one or not. And we were discussing over the weekend whether we should just go ahead and bite the bullet and take one of the other three vaccines. What's your opinion?
I think masks are highly effective. I know that there's a lot of anxiety about what's going on. I would support you either way. And as long as you don't have autoimmune disease, I would suspect that any of them is not going to harm you.
Okay, that's the sticker right there. My wife and I are both autoimmune.
And that gives me great concern. I don't have any more evidence than the study that came out of Israel a month or two ago that showed that, it's really hard to interpret. The global mortality rate seems to be about 0.1%. I have never seen it broken out for the mortality rate for people with autoimmune disease because it's mixed. Some people on prednisone aren't going to have a bad disease. Other people might. And so it's so hard to tell, but when they did the Israeli study with the Pfizer, it came out to 0.3% mortality for getting the shot versus the overall 0.1% mortality. It's still minimal. It's three times what the infection showed in the study, but it's still minimal. They had two people out of 685 die, which is still an issue. So it's difficult to sort through all the facts, but again, 0.3% mortality is only slightly above the 0.1% mortality that is from the infection.
Okay, well, I appreciate the info, Doc.
You're very welcome.
Have a great day. Bye.
You have a great day, too. Hey, I got an email here from Sean Canan. One of his colleagues, who is a physician, is also vegan. And the statement is there are no animal products of any kind in any of the COVID-19 shots.
That's good news.
That's good. Yeah.
You ready for Pat from Seminole?
Pat, yes. Let's talk.
Yes, good morning. Hey,
hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Now, I hope I'm not repeating a question. I just tuned in a few minutes ago. But I got my first Pfizer-BioNTech shot 4 weeks ago. And then I spoke to a friend of mine in Germany where the Pfizer-BioNTech shot was invented by a Turkish guy. And I said, well, I'm getting ready for my second shot in 3 weeks. And my friend said, why are you getting this shot in 3 weeks? You're supposed to get the shot in 6 weeks because the longer you wait to 6 weeks, it increases the efficacy of that particular shot. And I wanted to know if you have any information on that. And then secondarily, what are the effects of long-term proton pump inhibitors? Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. So first, there's probably a sweet spot, and it's probably 4 weeks. It may be 6 weeks, but 3 weeks is a bit early. I don't know why they would schedule that soon. I like the four-week spot. That's what most people have been doing. And if you do wait longer, it's not going to reduce it. It's just you have an extra 2 weeks where you're only at 30% efficacy, but does that really matter? I think 4 weeks is fine. 3 weeks is a bit early, but if you want your immunity to last longer and be stronger, yeah, wait 5 weeks, 6 weeks.
I'm going to go with six.
Good stuff. And then long-term use of proton pump inhibitors, One, it's addictive because you can't get off of them once you're on them for a long period because your stomach acid flow becomes horrendous the moment you stop it. So to get off of it, you need to use H2 blockers, antihistamines for the stomach, like Pepcid, Famotidine. And then the other things that are associated with long-term use of it are depression and osteoporosis. And as a woman, I would avoid proton pump inhibitors because you don't want to get osteoporosis.
Great. Good news. I know people on PPIs for years, and they say they can't live without it. And I'm like, you got to look into the effect. And I was just put on recently. I was told I was supposed to take 40 milligrams at, you know, for a day. It's a day, I mean, 20 and 20. And I'm resisting this. I don't think this is good for me. I mean, is it good for me?
it's not. Well, it's getting rid of symptoms, but it's not treating the problem. It's probably making other things worse. Low stomach acid prevents some of your protein digestion. It allows more parasites and other infectious agents to come in. You know, the reason that vultures can eat carrion with all those nasty rot bacteria on it is because they have such a high stomach acid content, nothing survives their stomach. But ours isn't like that if we take proton pump inhibitors. So we really need to make that change. And your friends that tell you they can't live without them, they can't because they're addicted. Their GI doctor, their primary care doctor, didn't tell them that proton pump inhibitors are addictive.
Huh. Well, and I don't have any symptoms of GERD, and I'm told I have GERD, and I'm told that I am early stage Barrett with hiatal hernia, and I don't feel any symptoms. But she's saying for the next 3 years, take 40 milligrams of PPIs a day, and I'm like, that sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
Well, asymptomatic reflux is usually associated, from my perspective, in my practice, with food sensitivities, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So you have a food sensitivity or you have a dysbiosis in your gut, and that should be addressed rather than covering up the symptom.
I have a what in my gut?
It's called dysbiosis, the wrong stuff growing. Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is one possibility. Another one is food sensitivity.
Holy crap.
So gluten, dairy, eggs, any of those things could be causing it, or other things like food additives like tartrazine yellow dye number 5. Or aspartame.
Well, you know, I am going to take my food choices as close to one ingredient or less than 5 ingredients, though, to get away from processed foods and go as natural as I can. I'd rather
change
my food choices rather than take a pill.
Yes, yes.
Cool, thank you.
No, sir. You're welcome.
Good day.
Yes, to you. Oh, hey, I have an email here from Bubba. Why are so many African Americans suffering from severe obesity? It's so sad. It's because the diet's wrong. I heard, it's funny, on NPR, 25 years ago, I heard a story that described what was going on. The guy was brilliant. He was like an ethnobotanist or a social anthropologist with medical training. It's the food. African-American diet, sub-Saharan Africa, was a keto diet. Protein, they caught game, they ate tubers and leaves as they gather hunted, because they're still gather hunters by genetics. And so eating sugar, eating excessive amounts of fat, because you got to remember the impala is exceptionally lean. There's no fat on those springboks and things down there in sub-Saharan Africa. So they get no fat, they except from nuts and things. It's mainly fiber and meat. And so when you slather barbecue sauce on your ribs and it's high fat, you put salt all over it. And salt's another thing that's absent in the African diet. All these things continue to add. Banana pudding, all these southern comfort foods, they're poison for the African American body. Hope that does it for you, Bubba.
All right, we're down to the lightning round. We got about 6 more minutes, so let's jump on in with Doug from Trinity.
Hello, Doug.
Hi, just a quick question. My wife has developed a bad case of tinnitus or tinnitus after the COVID vaccine. Was just wondering if you could offer any insight. She is autoimmune. She has autoimmune issues with her thyroid.
Okay. Well, I think some things you can do, always go to diet and look at the autoimmune protocol, AIP diet, or the WAHLS, W-A-H-L-S, apostrophe diet. Both are very good for cleaning up inflamed systems, both for autoimmune people. And then addition of things that calm down the inflammation, quercetin, curcumin, resveratrol, green tea, all very good at calming down this inflammation. Some fish oil might help because it's a nervous thing when you have tinnitus, so that may calm down the nerves a bit.
Got it. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a nerve-related issue for sure.
Yes.
Inflammation. Yes. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, and we've got Ann from Zephyr Hills here for us.
Hello, Ann.
Hi there. I'm taking Xarelto as a blood thinner to prevent AFib, and I was wondering if you could manage the blood thinning with aspirin, with just aspirin instead of Xarelto or any of the other blood thinners, the expensive blood thinners.
So the reason that you take Xarelto is because atrial fibrillation is a condition that causes you to have more risk of stroke.
Right.
Aspirin may reduce the risk of stroke a little bit, 25%, something like that. But compared to Coumadin, which lowers it by about 75%, Xarelto is even better because it lowers it by about 95%. So anytime you go away from these better, newer anticoagulants, you risk stroke.
Okay. Thank you.
It's better to take, you're welcome.
All right. Thank you very much.
You want to try one more there, Dr. Fred?
Sure. I think we have time.
Yeah, we do. You've got about 4 minutes, 3 minutes. It's got Linda from St. Pete.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I had a question to go back to the GERD, and a lot of my friends and clients have been prescribed the PPIs, which I'm aware of the detrimental long-term effects of these products. But I also encourage them to talk to a doctor or a nutritionist regarding digestive enzymes, adequate amounts of hydrochloric acid combined with a good quality probiotic. But I'm also curious about the correlation between diaphragmatic weakness and dysfunction as it plays a role with the esophageal sphincter. Would you be able to address this question for me?
That's a wonderful question. What's your name again?
Linda from St. Petersburg. I'm a massage therapist here in St. Petersburg.
Massage therapist. That was really, really very insightful. And I think, it's not crossed my mind before, but the moment you said it, I felt truth. And it's so American to have a weak diaphragm. We're sedentary. We don't exercise. We need to work on the diaphragm. And actually, that's one of the things that that man earlier said about his diaphragmatic breathing exercises. Just taking a walk around the block and paying attention to where your breathing is coming from. So it is coming from down below your navel is one way of strengthening that diaphragm. Wim Hof breathing is another technique that works on that. I would look at breath as a really important part of this. Thank you for that tip. I'm going to bring into my clinic.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And so we're down to about two more minutes, and we'll do the wrap-up phase here. What have you got?
Easy one. Any help for fluid retention and swelling in lower legs? We just talked about it. Diaphragmatic breathing. I had one person who actually had swelling and a lung problem. I sent them to a pulmonologist who did 3 hours worth of breathing testing because the patient just couldn't coordinate it. The next morning, they woke up, and they had zero swelling in their legs. The diaphragm pumps lymphatic fluid out of your legs. So doing even chair-based Tai Chi and using your diaphragm will reduce the swelling in your legs. So as I said, next week I would like to stay with genetics, genomics, and move it on into nutrigenomics and lifestyle genomic medicine so that we can talk about how we don't need to be our disease. We can actually fix that. Bill.
Yes, there, Dr. Fred.
Thank you for manning the phones and being my in-studio producer.
Oh, it's been a hoot. Always is there, Dr. Fred. You always give me a little bit of information that's very important to me. So I thank you. And remind everybody that they're listening to Dr. Fred on Health and Nutrition here on WMNF Tampa, 88.5 on your dial.